I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Professor Purushottama Binimoria, who is our visiting Shivdasani Fellow for this term. Professor Binimoria is mainly based in Deakin University, but also is a visiting professor at the University of California, if I'm correct, in Berkeley. He's got interest in Indian philosophy and epistemology broadly, and is particularly interested in ethics and developing Hindu philosophy of... Indian philosophy of ethics he's interested in developing. And he's got a number of... he's the editor of SOFIA, that magazine, that journal of Indian philosophy. And he's got very broad interest in virtue ethics and feminism as well. And I'm very, very pleased indeed that he's able to study with us this term. While I'm about it, Professor Binimoria is also open to having tutorials with students if anyone's interested in contacting him individually. Among his publications are most recently Indian Ethics with Ashgate and Shabda Pramana, Word and Knowledge, Testimony in Indian Philosophy, which is 2008, and an article which I haven't read, but I would love to read, Nietzsche as Europe's Buddha, which I very much look forward to reading in SOFIA as well. So, over to you.
Thank you. It's a great honour and a privilege to be back. And you see, I've got my Oxford tie from about 1983-84.
Yes.
My teacher, Bimal Matilab, was the book I find here. There's no more. I don't know, is this old soul? So what is it? I'm not quite sure how well it was written and how I picked it up. It hasn't been used since those days. We don't wear ties in Australia. nor in California, really much. Now this is it's a draft paper. I've been asked to write. I have written on so-called problem of evil and theodicy from the Indian perspective, but I've written from non-theistic perspective, sort of non-theistic schools that don't necessarily are committed to believe in a supreme deity being. But I got asked by a couple of philosophers who were putting together a volume on... it's called, I think it's a Blackwell Companion to the Problem of Evil and Theodicy. And they wanted me to do... Indian or I think maybe Indian theistic. Well, they wouldn't really matter because the Indian theistic are mostly Hindus anyway, right? They wouldn't be theistic in Buddhist or Jain. I suppose Sikh could count, but I think it's more classical. So anyway, they wanted me to do a theistic response, and I wrote back and I said, I really can't. I wouldn't be familiar with this material. I know the Purva Paksha, what I call the adversary's positions, but I wouldn't know. And that's hearsay. In other words, that's what a proponent would say, the opponent might say, but we don't know what the opponent's views would be or established thesis. So he said, no, we want you to do this. So I've been working on it, and I'm sort of scouring literature and so to find my way around. And you know, several people have written bits and pieces on it, but I think, generally speaking, it's there hasn't been a really one solid piece of a whole chapter on the theistic response, which I was surprised actually in some ways. And people get sidetracked into karma, which I will too, because it's unavoidable to speak of karma in the context of let us call it Indian theodicy. All right, so I'll start. This is how the problem of evil is often stated, and I think students of theology would know this. If God is all-powerful, omnipotent, and perfectly good, why is there evil in the world? Does the existence of evil prove that God does not exist? These questions belong to a particular type of theological debate, generally referred to as the problem of evil, which I'll dub as TPE, the problem of evil. And its supposed solution is known as theodicy. It's made of two words, theodicy, justice of God, justice, which really means a moral justification for the actions or inaction on the part of a benevolent God. a particularly Western monotheistic preoccupation, the problem of evil arises from the supposed inconsistency between God's attributes of omnipotence and goodness versus the presence of evil within God's creation. God would not be good if he knowingly created evil. So that's basically the problem, and we'll tease through this in. St. Augustine responded differently. If independent evidence leads us to conclude that God exists and is good, then he would be incapable of creating evil. Something else, then, must be its source. For him, evil is not a thing like other things in the world. Rather, it is a privation, meaning that which undermines or goes away from the reality of things, like the blemish on a perfectly crafted artwork. And you don't blame the artist for that, unless it's Jackson Pollock got drunk one day. But that made for another piece of art. Evil is any action or behavior that by intention or omission departs from the reality of something or someone that tends towards chaos and non-being. So it's very chancy. The possibility of this located in a great human good that God has bequeathed, free choice or free will. Evil is the product or consequence of the denial of human ambition, greed, anger, ego, wickedness, or sheer laziness in which one refuses to be one's self. Reality denied evil surfaces. It is not caused by human freedom, but rather from the misuse of it, or taking undue advantage of the freedom for untoward purposes, or what might be contrary to God's intended purpose and the moral order of existence. All of the suffering, pain, and hardships we undergo are in accordance with the just plan of God. Human volition accounts for at least all of the moral evil we experience, while evil brought about by natural processes like earthquakes, tsunamis, bushfires, floodings, etc. are called natural evil and have laws of nature or the irregular patterns therein to account for them. Sometimes pestilence might be said to be brought about through a mixture of natural and moral evils. Whole community is paying for their group karma. The Dalai Lama invokes something along these lines to account for the current stateless predicament of the Tibetan people. Or God might have greater and higher good in mind that we humans do not understand. God's existence and moral impeccability stands justified, at least in the eyes of the theist. So that's the defense coming from the theist side. There are objections to this account, and while someone might accept that God did not create evil that is in the world, nevertheless, since there is so much of it, of insufferable scale and magnitude, and he does not block evil or prevent it, even if he could, allowing innocent beings, humans and animals, and consider the suffering of children, as Dostoevsky pointed out, to suffer as a consequence, God is either not all-powerful, omnipotent, or not a good God at all. How is it that human beings, on the basis of their free will, are able to act contrary to God's will? Wouldn't this pose limitations on his willpower? In short, an all-powerful God created something or bestowed on his creation an attribute that cannot be controlled by divine powers, and this is a contradiction. David Hume's oft-quoted lines have the same resonance. Is he, God, willing to prevent evil but not able to? Then he is impotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Whence there is evil. Hume asks, why couldn't he have created us with stronger virtues so that we would always freely choose good deeds over bad temptations? We can't be said to have free will if the outcome could limit our free will in that when we have to suffer the consequences, we have no choice, no free will to opt out of that, but to bear the pain, suffering, and indeed punishment. Again, why did God not guarantee that there be no bad deeds, or he himself suffer if he so loves his creation, and if suffering or pain does not diminish his infinitely perfect stature, take on all of our suffering? Now, of course, there are responses from within, at least Christianity, that God does take on our suffering through sending his Son, Christ, and so on. The response from Theodicy is that, yes, God could have ensured that there are no bad deeds, but in his infinite wisdom, he let, so to speak, the dice roll. And secondly, that a universe equal to God's own supreme identity is not conceivable, for that would be no universe at all as we know and experience it. So in other words, you can't have the perfect, most perfect world that would compete with God's nature. Thus, God created the best of all possible worlds, as Leibniz put it, in a maximal moral sense. And his omniscience, though perhaps not omnipotence, is not compromised in any way. By stating that suffering has some deeper teleology, That is to say, suffering essentially has a purpose, and the theodicies believe this purpose to be moral in nature and must be worth the devastation it leaves in its wake. Therefore, it must be worth the devastation it leaves in its wake. D.C. Phillips explains that the existence of evil makes it possible for one to be morally responsible by coming to the aid of those who are victims of evil. So kind of like an altruism. Richard Swinburne similarly suggests that evil is the price that must be paid if we are to have greater responsibilities for each other, and that the sufferer is of use to us in helping us to grow. Although it can be shown, as Charles Darwin argued, pain and horrific suffering among animals, and in cases like human Holocaust, India's partition, the horrors of 9/11 and its aftermath, there seemed no clear purpose of any high moral order. It all ends in terrorized death. Some like John Hick wedge a distance between human and animal suffering, arguing that the higher the intelligence in the species, the higher and nobler the purpose in God's eye. So we know that we are suffering, and why, animals may not know, but that's just too bad. So the theist argument is formalized in this way. So there is a sort of a formalization, which is, sometimes it's in five premises, but most people say that three is enough to show the contradiction. There exists a perfectly good God. There are 10 to the power of 13 terps of evil in the world. I mean, the measure doesn't mean anything. It's like E equals MC squared. There's no real significance to that. It's just a way of saying there's an enormous amount of evil in the world that you can't measure. All the evil in the world is moral evil due to the freedom of sentient beings. Right. So this argument just basically says that God remains perfectly good. Evil in the world, dukkha in the Indian tradition, really is due to the free will or the misuse of free will by human beings. And we might add a happy ending finale to this. God's grander than imaginable plan or purpose. This God might have a bigger purpose than we realize. What D implies, the last one, the fourth, is that the evil we witness and suffer in the world is really part of God's design for a purposeful world, or greater happiness in life hereafter, heaven, rebirth, so on. John Hick called this soul-making. So an eternal future good justifies and redeems all the pain and suffering, sin and sorrow, which have occurred on the way to it. So in Western theodicy, this is called compatibilism or compossibility. Coexistence of good and evil in the world. God was never intended to be a maximally pleasure-only maximizer. In other words, God allows for some degree of evil or suffering to happen. So despite all the horrendous evil around, it is not inconsistent to believe that there is a perfectly good God who at the same time is not expected to eliminate all evil as far as he could, insofar as he shows grace and forgiveness. We have to participate in God's grand plan and the challenges he throws at us continually, and heed to the occasional interventions he makes in history via revelation, sending down his son, or avatar forms or messengers, and be open to growth and betterment. So this in outline is the Western paradigm. I mean, there's lots and lots and lots of debates and subtleties and qualifications and so forth that can be brought into this, which I have no intent, we won't have time. But I want to move on to the Indian scenario. My purpose today is to critically consider Hindu and broadly Indic responses to the so-called problem of evil in theodicy, to bring the same questions to the tradition, and different ones also, if the ones above are not exhaustive and not pertinent to the present context. In other words, they may have a different agenda. I first made a search of all the many theistic traditions that I have been able to find in the vast body of literature, and then turned to non-theistic systems. But I'll interview the non-theistic systems in here for this purpose, for the counter-arguments against the theodicy, but also examine their own alternative explanations of or solutions to the supposedly ubiquitous problem of evil. One caveat should be noted at the outset. As Reichenbach rightly observes, the problem of evil as generally found in the Indian philosophical tradition rests not on the question of existence and the nature of God, but rather on the question whether there is universal justice. Why is there so much suffering? And that's Buddha's first noble truth. There is suffering. that there is a cause, but it doesn't sort of say, well, you know, let's blame God for it. So, evidence for this thesis can be found in the fact that the problem of evil in a theological guise, that is with reference to God, is rarely treated directly in classical or medieval Indian literature. What this means in effect is that the question of the relation of God to pain, suffering and dysfunction is much less significant or even insignificant in the Indian karmic systems. And the reason has to do not so much with the law of karma, to which shortly, as with their respective views of God, or the supremely divine in formless form, nirguna saguna forms. There isn't a great degree of variation to the problem of evil, as distinct from theodicy, between, say, theistic and non-theistic systems. Thus, the Jains, Buddhist, Hindu Mimamsa on the non-theistic side may find themselves in good company with theistic Vedanta. So, in other words, the preoccupation seems to be something else, not so much about the question of God, but about perhaps the role of karma, you know, something of that kind. Both want to understand why it is that persons experience pain and pleasure, fortune and misfortune in ways that seem unconnected with moral quality of their present actions, and ultimately how this cycle of suffering can be escaped, can be broken. Justification of divine ways and action is rarely taken for its own sake, save to ponder on the role of God in the aforementioned quest and how creation may be implicated in teasing out the mechanics of karmic processes. So that's a sort of qualification which will tell us the sort of direction in which we, you know, we are to be going, and so that's why we just sort of simply can't sort of take it on board and say, they don't really have a problem with theodicy because they haven't factored in, you know, targeted it on the question of God's existence. Well, that's not really the approach. Hence, all the Indian accounts and attempted explanations invariably involve or invoke karma as part of the solution, the non-theistic and theistic explanations alike. The latter, the theistic ones, implicate the inexorable principle of karma to a large measure in the way God is said to dispense and maintain justice, moral, just order in the universe. Karma's functioning is not unlike the laws of nature or of natural law in Western theodical accounts. So what is karma? Now, I presume people know karma. Do I have to go over? I don't think I have to. So I'll just, perhaps just one bit I might summarize. And a couple of things may be mentioned, that the sedimented residual karma that we accumulate as we do actions or think or whatever it is that we engage in through our mind, body, spirit, perhaps even, they ripen not all at once, but may ripen later on, so known as prarabdha, or they may be deferred and get liquidated at a future time, anarabdha, or future time being future time in this life, or perhaps in another life as well. And sometimes it's sort of arguable whether rebirth is a consequence of a theory of karma or karma theory is a consequence of rebirth. That's still debate goes on. Anyway, the burden of the unexhausted karma is what helps perpetuate the chain of seamless continuity of an individual's existence and create conditions for good life, life of suffering, good death or bad death. And so that's really where the retribution is coming from karma rather than from any divine being and so on. But then we'll see what role God has in the theistic account. So in simpler terms, karma is described as the principle of universal causality resulting from our actions. Every meritorious and virtuous deed and every negative act leaves its impress or trace on the psyche, which in turn determines the character of the individuals as well as the disposition to behave in certain way or ways. The ethical implication is that whatever good or bad one performs, one must reap the results. Good deeds lead to happiness, bad deeds lead to suffering. The retributive results are proportionate to the gravity of the act. To guard against an excessively fatalistic reading of the doctrine, one could say that there is no reason why, according to this theory, some people's greed and avarice could not lead them to enjoy fortune or cause unwanted misfortune to others. Persons who were cheated might never recover their loss in kind, but would nevertheless be owed something by the accomplished, which the inexorable law of karma will take care of in its own inimitable way. All right. What this means is that the actions generate their own intrinsic moral consequences, however benign or otherwise the intentions may be on the part of the performer. Certain acts violate general or universal principles such as fair entitlements, desert or rights of another, discrimination on grounds of gender and race, and one's responsibility to oneself and others. Also, certain acts lead to irreparable and irreversible damage, such that the performer of this act must bear responsibility for the consequences of the act, the burden of which must surely pass over to the moral sphere. In other words, actions may be rightly judged in respect of rules they violate or consequences they lead to, or in respect of the act, qua act, on the premise that certain acts are intrinsically and inherently wrong, bad, or undesirable. Murder, for example, regardless of consequences and intentions and motivations, wars and scenarios and all those arguments that may be made. The same ethical considerations apply to karma. Telling the truth on the principle that one only ever utters the truth through testimony or disclosure of a flight path to a bandit in a situation that one knows will lead to the wrongful killing of an otherwise innocent being or victim will incur the testifier with the wrath of karma. That's more in Mahabharata, not so much in Ramayana, where absolute truth is required. But, you know, if you're telling someone what seemed to be an honest truth leads to greater harm and damage, then you are not circumspect about, you know, your implication in the death of someone else. So you've got to think that fast. The legalistic charges in the court of law may be mitigated against him, or as might be the resulting suffering, via merciful intervention of a deity, guru, or through penitence. But the moral burden of the act rests squarely on the shoulder of the individual, rather than be left as a matter of judgment or adjudication or pardon by an external human or divinely punitive or be denying agency. The application of the law may extend beyond the individual person to groups and even to nations as well, as the great epic, the Mahabharata, amply illustrates in its long and complex ethical ruminations. Now, this is basically, at this point, the non-theistic response. You know, it just says, here's karma, it does all the tricks, if you like, and, you know, there's nothing outside of it that can change the situation very much or even be held responsible, because the moral ramifications of what one does and so on. Now we test to see how the theory pans out in different responses to the problem of evil, attempted and attempted theodicy. So one could say, well, this is the general theory, not necessarily non-theistic. I shouldn't have said that it's non-theistic. It's just the general theory. And there will be different responses from theistic ones and non-theistic ones of how it operates. The non-theistic ones will say, well, you've just given us an account. That's exactly how it works. Where the theistic ones will say, hang on, no, it's not entirely quite like that. There's still more to it. So we begin with one of the theistic schools, Nyaya. This is the school of logic, but it also happened to have great arguments for the existence of God, albeit a bit later in the tradition. God arrives in the Nyaya a little after its foundation, possibly with the commentator Vatsyayana, perhaps in the 4th century BC. The Nyaya work up the most sophisticated argument or proofs, if you like, in the Indian tradition for the existence of God. Now, we won't go into this here, but only look at aspects where the arguments are confronted by the problem of evil. A godlike being called Ishvara has divine qualities that include being single, unitary, omnipresent, vibhu, omniscient, sarvabhid, and eternal, shashvat. So his God is sort of almost like, you know, if you like, timeless. These are all the qualities that any divine, omnipotent, monotheistic God would be presumed to have. So Ishvara, not unlike the potter, does not produce the universe ab initio, much less out of nothingness. Rather, he is dependent on pre-existing materials, the remnants possibly from the previous pralaya or destruction, collapse, entropy, plus dyads, triads of atomic traces and karmas of the universe at large. So you see, there isn't a creation out of nothingness or even the... It's probably more like the spider scenario, you know, the web emanated out of himself. But here it's even more like Plato's demiurge, the architect exercising his sankalpa, his divine power, intentions, wishes, and with the help of deities and other divine beings, creates a universe. And those deities, divine beings, might be entrusted with the task of trading together, a yojana, inert atoms and properties, and even to provide support for an upright and operative cosmos. This is not a case of creationism as such, or even a case of creation as such, in the way in which we understand, say, the biblical creation. But still, one would expect God to be in full control over his dominion. As to the question of theodicy, the defense is that God, through his omniscient state, controls the operation of karma, which is binding on all selves except God's self, and through his yogic powers dispenses rewards and punishments on the basis of the individual's merits and demerits, punya and pap. But at the same time relies on human efforts in regulating the cosmos. So, you know, God is sort of dependent on human beings to regulate the cosmos by following a certain moral order, and the planets and so forth to follow a natural order. The planets can't go against God, against the natural order, but human beings can go against the moral order, because we have free will and we have intentions and we have desires and we have consciousness, and we are rebellious. At the end of the day, compassion marks God's intentionalities, even in the face of natural calamities and misfortunes that are caused by an individual's previous karma. God is not responsible for them. God's compassion also has its limitations, for he is respectful of the law of karma and leaves people to work off their karma in ways most appropriate and conducive for their salvific future. So nothing like the Western religious concept of providence features in this account, because there is neither a full-on creation nor a very decisive teleology nor any sense of continuous presence throughout history. There are some variations among Nyaya thinkers on more particular issues, as those questions raised by the Mimamsa, very much in the spirit of Hume, as we saw earlier. Basically, from the imperfection of the world and whether God botched up the job, is callous, indifferent, lacking in compassion, and why does the huge amount of bad karma that abounds in the world does not bring blemish upon God's nature? Is he really in control? The short answer usually is that human effort can both be culpable and efficacious to countering the ills of existence. That is the law of karma. It also means that being thus free to choose, human beings are not pawns in the hands of a superior power. But won't there be greater justice possible if God actually did intervene, rather than letting the brute, impersonal operations of karma determine outcomes? Incapable of permitting another chance, or some rehabilitative dispensation, rather than rigid cold-blooded retribution in respect of bad karma? Why does God allow that? Not be a little more... compassionate. And do all good karma get rewarded equally and fairly? Human beings complain about this, and it does not account for the presence of natural evil. So, you know, that's another whole phenomenon itself, you know, the natural evil, earthquakes, tsunamis, and so forth. You know, what accounts for that? Wouldn't a personal judge be a better place to make adjustments and compensate a culprit or a victim from the good karmas and track record, etc.? In other words, a personal agent fully in charge, rather than having an impersonal automated computer sort of run the show. Is it moral to accumulate good karma or merely prudential? And this is a very important question. Is it moral to accumulate good karma or merely prudential? Prudential meaning, you know, good enough, but, you know, not really of great moral significance. I mean, you know, whether you feed your cat, you know, if you can train it to be vegetarian, or you feed dry food, or you feed canned food, or you feed raw meat, sort of there are prudential matters. Perhaps the vegetarian one might be a moral issue, but the other choices are prudential. But there are clearly more moral consequences when it comes to accumulating or accruing bad karma. So there isn't a proportionate balance conceptually and ontologically between the planks of good and bad karma. In other words, if I do good karma, it's not really so, it doesn't morally register there, and, you know, I will get God's really good graces and so forth. But if I do bad karma, it'll hit me immediately, it'll hit me hard, right? So that's the, you know, the state doesn't reward us for all the good things that we do, right? We run around, we have good thoughts, we're kind to people, you know, we give money to beggars and poor people and so on. Nobody takes any notice of that. But if you do something wrong, you know, you're rounded up by police and so on and so forth. That's the point here. Is the theory of karma aligned with God as an available, but too often inaccessible moderator, than a cop-out? He's available, but not accessible. If God does or can interfere with the operation of the law of karma, it is said to be the case in Vaisheshika, which is a later school after, not a later school, but in Nyaya, and part of Nyaya school, but in a later period, the God can interfere with the operation of the law of karma. Does it mean that there could be something unjust, not quite right in the operation of karma? In other words, if karma is going along and is doing, you know, not really delivering the right kind of balances to things, then God intervenes and says, oh, well, look, you know, I think I'm going to make some adjustments here. That means that the law under which capital punishment was operating was unjust. And this is a fight that's still going on in America. In California, we have a new Attorney General, Kamala Harris, who's part Indian and part African-American, so part Gandhian also, wants capital punishment sort of to be wiped out. But this is not happening. In other words, there can be laws in the past that were unjust under which you were incriminated. And so, you know, bad luck for those people who got hung, like Ned Kelly in Australia, right? I mean, these things, you can't bring them back. So the state didn't know and put in these laws about capital punishment. So, but God must have known that this is not going to be right. So why did God allow this kind of laws to be operating? Perhaps impersonal law is neither just nor unjust, so it's neutral. It does what it is programmed to do, regardless, but then the programmer has to take some responsibility for that. But if it cannot be mitigated either by God or human free will to a large extent, then it is a case of hard determinism. In other words, we're sort of living in a hard deterministic world, and we have a God. So there's a contradiction going on. We may note in passing that the karma theory is not intended to explain the origins or beginnings of the cycle of birth and rebirth, nor as a complete and systematic explanation of human suffering. Rather, as Shada and Takakis point out, the karma theory wishes, I quote them, the karma theory wishes to reflect our ignorance in the face of the complexity of reality by offering only a sketchy account as to why humans suffer, one that is based on the unargued assumption that the universe is ultimately just, or God is just. Various accounts attempt to fill in the gaps and details, though unsatisfactorily, on the inner workings or mechanics of the karmic process. The concern in theodicy is not to get bogged down in these details and lacks, but rather to find a solution to the problem of evil and, as it were, save God from the charges by non-theists of corruption, compromise, and possible malevolence, as we do to our politicians. Well, let's move on. We turn now to the Vedanta schools. There's various sub-branches within it for even more complicated nuances, and there's about 3 bookshelves of books on, you know, of this kind on Vedanta, that commentaries and so forth that I've been scouring through and trying to get some sense out of them. Now, we'll start with the adversarial position, so the Purva Pakshin, as it's called. He objects that it is false to impute God as the cause of the world. It's interesting. I mean, there's an argument about whether or not God created the world or not, but then what's invoked here is a problem of evil. Because, he says, good and evil are dispensed unevenly. This is very interesting that you know, we could deny creation because good and evil are dispensed unevenly. There is great misery in the world, and he periodically destroys the world. You know, what kind of a God would he be? So in reply, the author of the Brahma Sutra invokes the law of karma. So 2133 of Brahma Sutra says that God, the creator, cannot be unjust or cruel, for he is not independent in his act of creation, and the scripture shows his dependence upon other factors such as karma or the creature's dharma and adharma, that's merit and demerit. Shankara quotes in support from Shruti, from scriptures, as well as from the Bhagavad Gita. First point to note is that it is said that creation has no beginning, it is anadi. Second, emphasizes that the creation is sapeksha, the creator is not independent. So nirpeksha would have been to say that the creator is independent, but he's not, this is sapeksha. Though he is the sole material cause of the world, he does not have free choice. That is, he has no control over dispensing either fortune or misfortune. He simply acts according to the dictates of the law of karma. Shankara adds another dimension to the causality of God. He says that there's a parjanayavat. Rainfall is common cause for the production of rice, barley, etc. Rainfall does not show any favor or disfavor to the various seeds that are shown. Therefore, likewise, the Lord is impassionate. In other words, the Lord does not discriminate either. The varieties any inequalities of the creatures are due to the Lord's dependence upon the special factors in each case, the particular nature of the creature, which is usually determined by the destiny or the accumulated karma of the creature itself. So there is not a predestination in the way that you have in Christianity, but there is a kind of a sort of karmic destination. The next sutra, 2134, raises and answers the obvious objection to this position. In the very beginning of creation, no karma existed. So whence the diversity? How does karma come about? Answer, there was no such beginning. Just as time has no beginning, and then 2136 tries to justify this notion of beginninglessness. First, the question is raised. If karma is the factor on which creation depends, then creation is also a factor on which karma depends. And so which one was first? This is ruled out as an idle question, for it is exactly like the seed and sprout, and in the Western case, egg and chicken controversy. Second, had there been a beginning of creation, it would have started by a pure accident or causelessly. Now, you see, what's interesting about this, I also write on science and religion and sort of some of the arguments about the beginningless of the universe and so forth, which now some of the scientists propound, ties in so closely with what's going on here. How on earth did these people think up of something like that? The universe could be beginninglessness. They had no scientific evidence or stretch of time infinitely and so forth. Most people would tend to want to talk about, because this is created, therefore that must be created as well. And that's what the old logic school nyayas did. And these people were not even doing logic. They were just doing some kind of intuition and had this this thought. It's been there in the Greek traditions too, of course. So this seems to be a reminiscent of the why not sooner argument, which is found to be tackled by Greek and scholastic philosophers in the West as well. So, you know, is it causeless? And why didn't it happen before? Why did it happen now? When did it happen? And so on. It's all shrouded in something of a mystery. There's sort of no really clear answers to these things. They tend to get into sort of bogged down into linguistic debates rather than actual metaphysical debates. Besides, creatures would have to suffer a lot for which they are not at all responsible. And the varieties and inequalities of creatures' happiness and unhappiness would be unaccounted for if, you know, if it were sort of just a creation with no agency involved in it at all. To avoid such absurd consequence, one has to admit the beginninglessness of creation. Okay, so there are two ways of saying this. We say, well, if a God had created this, there might have been inequality in happiness and unhappiness. Therefore, we rule him out and say the world was created beginninglessness, sort of came about. Shankara adds, if the beginninglessness is accepted, since it follows the process of seed and sprout regularity, no fault will arise. So there's no fault on the part of anyone about the equality and inequality. It's still a bit complicated. I haven't sort of quite absolutely figured out how he then wants to bring God into the picture. You know, if the beginninglessness accounts for a sort of much better state of things, and then, you know, where does karma get going? How does it start happening, and so on? They don't really explain at all. On this, Madhila remarks, however, there seems to be a way out, even without our considering the beginninglessness hypothesis of the Hindus. If there was a beginning, and the beginning was a happy one, but free creatures were created, and if through the exercise of free will, they brought about inequalities upon themselves, then the alleged absurdity vanishes. So either you say, well, at some point, you know, the people were created and they had free will and they abused it, and so there is this. But I think Shankara wants to say, no, it's been beginningless, it's been going on. So there's no point at which karma actually came in. It just, whenever you are born, at whatever time, at whatever period, the minute you started acting, you accumulated karma, QED. I mean, it makes sense in some ways. Be that as it may, the uniqueness of the Hindu idea of beginninglessness of the universe in cyclical permutation of creation, dissolution, and creation, and God's dependence on the world rather than the converse, renders God not as independent and existing outside, nigh prior to the created world, which marks the idea of God in Judeo-Christian monotheistic tradition. God is bound by the karmas of the individual creatures, even after their bodies have been dissolved along with the world. So, you got the beginningless universe, karmas and things are going on, not so much karmas and things are going on. Yes, I guess that's what he means. And then God comes into the picture, and yes, and all what he does is that he recreates the world from the karma and the residues and the atoms and whatever was around. It's, if you know Plato's Timaeus, he does something similar. There's a receptacle, he pours things into it, does a good mix, and comes out, you know, beings and creatures and so on and so forth, you know, templated with whatever karmas you had left behind from a previous cyclic existence, so and so forth, right? So all that's all that God does. God is bound by the karmas of the individual creatures. Whether God could in his merciful wisdom wipe out all traces of karma and begin to be in a world on quite different laws and principle, natural and moral, is not a thinking on which there is any unanimity in the Hindu tradition. The possibility is suggested in the adage kartum akartum anyatha kartum cha shaknoti. He can do it, undo it, or even do it in another way. But one thing is clear is that the Shapekshatva dependence thesis, which the Brahma Sutra underlines and which Shankara amplifies as God's dependence upon the karma of the creatures, seriously limits, that is, restricts God's omnipotence, which will not be shared by any of the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Secondly, Motilal contends the karma doctrine has its own philosophical problems, and I think we've already shown something of this kind, the problem that it's not complete and so on. There is a substantive third issue. Karma cannot be sustained without the hypothesis of transmigration. Again, the whole thesis of transmigration has to be sort of established in some way for this to sustain. Anyway, the fourth thing that Motilal says is that it leads to some kind of a fatalism. So he says, you know, the caste system and so forth continue and so on. But I think that's overstating the case. In fact, it does allow, karma theory does allow for the moral agency to be able to mitigate the samskaras, the traces, by controlling or sublimating the vasanas, the deeper residues that are left behind from actions, and transforming herself through yogic practices, repentance, service, and in theistic models, supplicating God for his saving grace. There is a part here that I think I might just sort of miss here. All it's saying is that, you know, there isn't a sort of a hard necessary connection between a moral, between any act and the moral value and its result. The karma theory sort of has a much looser kind of a hold on this. So it's not hard determinism. It's as though an individual might choose to act otherwise. That's the principle. As Krishna sermons to Arjuna in the concluding verses of the Bhagavad Gita, thus has wisdom more secret than secrecy itself been declared unto thee by me. Having reflected over it fully, then act thou as thou judge it best. So even though there is karma theory all implicated, you do as you judge it best. So the theistic solution to the problem of evil is that God cannot be held responsible for the evil in the world because he simply administrates the consequences of our karmic act. It is the individual agents which are morally responsible. But surely it is contradictory to say that God is omnipotent and yet cannot control, mitigate, or ameliorate, or break it out when deemed prudent, the force of karma in the strict or rigid sense in the way in which the non-theistic schools rely on. And I have a term for that theory. Instead of theodicy, I call it karmodicy. So I've got to invented a new word here, karmodicy. However, there would be a contradiction if there was a hard necessary truth here, but there isn't a hard necessary truth because, you know, it's the case that God cannot square a round circle. God may be able to create a boulder that he can or cannot lift up the hill, but he could find some other device by which he could lift the boulder up, but he cannot square a round circle. And that's basically what the law of karma is. It's a principle, and God can't violate that principle. So there's a logical constraint on God as well. Now, Ramanuja, and I've not much to go, just a few pages, a couple of pages. Ramanuja, in his Sri Bhashya commentary on the Brahma Sutra, has basically similar arguments and counter-arguments against the stock of objections raised by the skeptic. The difference is that in Ramanuja's case, as in most Vaishnava accounts, God is the unchanging Brahman, in its supreme deity form as Vishnu, Narayan, is the material and efficient cause of the world, which he ensouls as its inner self, Sarira, in which he also sustains and destroys at the end of the epoch, not as an intentional act or purposefully, but out of a sense of play, lila, sport, and he's thus not morally accountable for his acts. Now, you can sort of get God out of the picture by saying, well, we're just having a bit of fun kicking a ball around. Sport. But then again, you know, it's not as sort of wild and violent and rowdy as, you know, football teams go. I think God has some kind of, you know, control about this as well. It's a sport, but it's a nice sport. It's a bit like golf, I guess. Well, wouldn't it be? I mean, yeah. It takes a long time to tee a hole. To the objection that God would be implicated with mercilessness near there for the unequal creation, Ramanuja retorts, a king who is perfect or complete, paripurna, may still engage in activity for the sake of sport. A particular creation may be due to the omniscient Lord's realizing that the state of material nature requires a new creation, while the unequal status of the creatures is caused by their respective karmas. For the essence of God and the evil deeds is they pleasing or displeasing the Supreme Being, thus giving rise to his favor or wrath. So you can see now God is a little bit more in the picture in this account than he was in the previous account. Here God is inside you, so he's watching. He's your closed circuit TV. I got really worried after reading this because I used to hang around here till 11 at night and I burnt one of those crays, one of those the other day a little bit, and I thought, God's watching. He'll tell Shona that I did that.
And no one told me.
Oh, I put wrong paper in the photocopy or something like that. And I'm now it is, so with all this, yes, he told you that, yes, with all the statues and things around, I'm really quite scared. The supreme, more scared of the inner one than the outer one, you see. So the supreme person who is the Lord engages in sport befitting his greatness, determines that certain deeds are good and others are bad, and gives finite selves bodies and sense organs and power of controlling them. He enters these souls as the inner self, as the antaratma, or antaryami, also called, and abides within them, controlling them as one who permits them to act. When the finite selves have performed good or evil actions according to their respective wishes, the Lord recognizes the one who performs good actions as the one who obeys his commands, prospers him with four goals of human attainment, righteousness, prosperity, fulfillment of physical desires, and salvation, while he causes the one who transgresses his commands to experience just the opposite of these blessings. Of course, it is not necessary that the Lord, lying half asleep on his shesha couch, afloat on the milky ocean, occasionally personally attends to each and every action of the individual agents and their effects. So sometimes I think he's asleep. This task he happily bequeaths to the lesser gods and ultimately to the automated law of karma. So this account, however, embeds a particular dilemma. Suppose it is the case that every person is a fully free agent, and he can choose to act in a certain way or desist from it. That is his moral freedom, which carries a certain liability also in terms of the accrual of karmic residue. Since on Ramanuja's account, the Lord has entered the agent as the inner controller, the antaryamin, as a function of his universal causality. So technically speaking, he, God, is also the cause of free moral actions of the agent. So the Lord is the real agent, not the individual being. He is implicated in our actions, good and bad. We know that many proclaim enlightened beings, gurus and highly attained adepts, make such unitary claims. So why burden the individual with the moral blame? Or for that matter, with praiseworthiness for the good? We often hear people say, it was not my achievement, it is the Lord's doing, it is his wish, I'm just a pawn, Baba, right? We often hear, well, why not for the bad ones too? We often hear, I think, you know, we don't hear people say that God led me to, you know, steal the loaf of bread. Although I'm not quite sure whether that was the case when all those things were going on here. If anybody ever made that claim?
Sandhills, the Adivasis.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, the Robin Hood type thing, yeah. The people make such self-effacing. Well, why can't this be universalized in the negative karmic disachievement case as well? Once, in case of one's personal blunders, catastrophes, harms caused to others, and so on. Ramanuja, as Liebner reports, has a solution to this problem. The Supreme Self, and we're quoting the text, the Supreme Self has bestowed equitably on all conscious beings all the equipment required for performing or desisting from action. For example, the capacity for the power of thought, for the power of willing, and so on. To bring this about, he has become the support of these beings, and having entered within them, exercises control as the consenter to actions rather than as the doer of actions, being established as the principle. The individual conditioned by these powers, endowed by the Supreme Self, itself performs the desist from the action. The Supreme Self merely witnesses the doing and remains impartial. Thus, all is in order. In other words, we say, you know, he will give you as long a rope as you want to hang yourself with. As Lipner elaborates, it is the individual agent which acts freely, while the Lord, as the individual's existential support, his Adhara, allows this action to be realized to take being. But Lipner has his doubts about the veracity of this cooperative solution. God seems to be complicit in the agent's supposedly freely chosen bad action over a possible good one. For is the agent's act of will in the first place dependent upon the consent of the Lord or not? If it is, how is the agent really free to initiate action? If it is not, the Lord is not universal cause. There is the added problem of the Lord's consenting to bring an evil action of a finite agent into being. In other words, it's like a sort of policeman sitting, you know, sitting by watching you do bad action. They should intervene. Must he not be responsible for it in some way? Yet Ramanuja has sought to no more than provide an illuminating analogy. And the analogy is that the property by joint owners, you don't really require the consent of the other person to transfer your property to the third person. Now, that may be so at a particular time in India where you don't ask your wife or your spouse whether you could, you know, transfer the property or your younger brother. But that wouldn't hold true in the law of court today. So this is only a partial explanation for the cooperation between the Lord and the individual Atman in the performance of free action. But what about the acts of the Lord himself, namely creation, sport, dissolution, and so on? Do these not affect or accrue any karma for him? Ramanuja has an answer, and the principle on which this is based, I'm just about done, is more clearly in the Bhagavad Gita. When one performs an act without any thought or desire for the result, it does not accrue binding karma. The act is performed not out of desire, necessity, or lack, but out of fullness of being. Since God acts without any desire, his actions are not karma binding. And yet God is said to have desires, goals, and objectives. So this admission might contradict the more restricted claim. Surely in Ramanuja's cosmology, God is actively involved in the world. Even if he had a modicum of desire, that those who offer him devotion and sankirtan will eventually fulfill their desires and attain liberation. Conferring a distribution of grace, prasada, also calls for certain telic intentionality, in other words, some kind of, you know, purpose, so you do something for me. At the end of the day, God's role is cosmogonic and administrative and little else. So that's the story, but it doesn't look like as if that's that morally lets God off the hook. Finally, on the question of whether the evil swirling around the world and all the impurities, inauspiciousness and pollution could sully God's own pure nature, Ramanuja is adamant that the Supreme Brahman is devoid of even the slightest trace of evil that is found to exist in all the intelligent and non-intelligent things. The Supreme Brahman is the opposite of all that is evil and the soul of all auspiciousness. He is entirely distinct from all other things, end quote. Oh, and another commentary on that. The imperfection of the evolved does not affect the perfection of the unevolved evolver, end quote. However, how this panentheistic deity can remain separate enough from what evolves out of him, which includes evil and imperfection, to be perfect is unclear. This is a rather Bruce Reichenbach asking. Perhaps the imperfections are ontological, the fabric of the world, hence God's body, but not moral. But if God is also, it's a bit like the imperfection of Jupiter when it gets hit by a meteoroid, it breaks apart, and then the parts that fall off are larger than the size of the Earth. Now, that's a sort of an imperfection in the furniture of the universe. But if God is also the soul in each person, unity of Jivatma and Brahman, then the blemish in my soul should also ipso facto register a black mark in God's higher self as well. Why does God then not suffer pains from our evils? And so this seems a strange way of trying to save God from any possible blemish that may occur, albeit as an existential guna, quality, from the evils that afflict human beings in the environment. Now, this is the last paragraph. Later Vedanta schools, perhaps in cognitions of this possible blight on God's pure nature, wage a greater distance between sentient beings and God, beginning with Madhva through Vallabhacharya, Nimbarka, Baladev, various other people, and right across the Gaudiya Vaishnava theologies as well. It is maintained that God and the world are different, just as two individuals and the individual and the world are different. Now, I don't quite understand what Veda, Aveda, it's a sort of a difference and non-difference. It's a sort of principle that they take from Ramanuja and seem to run right across, even though they're sort of separating God and the world. It means in this context, I think we should read it as Veda, Veda, double difference, sort of all-round difference. And so that's how he's able to behold the karma, dukkha, consequent upheavals and demise of the wayward creature, but remain at some distance. But for a small dose of prasada or grace, there is not much else that God can be expected to do of a redemptive kind. Lift the poor chap in a chariot of clouds to heaven or paraloka. Our mythology suggests such divinely interventionist feats, but it is hard to make sense of this report theologically and philosophically. Even so, the question is not whether God can ultimately liberate the individual from the condition of suffering at death or in time future. The question is, why does God allow suffering in the first instance? Why does it allow it to go on? Why does the suffering go on, causing much damage? And why has he installed a blindingly impersonal, hardwired, compassionless law of karma that keeps sentient beings knotted in binding karmas from even before the time they are born and after they die? So there are many such questions left unanswered, and even more glaringly so in the combined theokarmic DC accounts. So the combining theo-DC with karmic in the middle, it doesn't sort of, you know, fair, whether you call it karmic theo-DC or it doesn't really seem to make a difference. And should we then end with Immanuel Kant's misgiving about the failure of all attempted theodicies? I rest my case here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.